Okay, it's nice to be back with everyone. It's standing room only today. Ian is in charge of crowd control. Okay, my father said we're on the 18th chapter. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Chapter 18 called The Perfection of Renunciation from Srimad Bhagavad Gita, and it's text number 13. Repetition. Everyone together.
Panchayatani mahabaho karanani nibodhame sankhye kritante proktani siddhaye sarvakarmanam.
O mighty armed Arjun, according to the Vedanta, there are five causes for the accomplishment of all action. Now learn of these from me. Next one.
Adhishthanam tatha kartha karanam cha prithak vidham vividhascha prithak cheshta daivam jayvatra panchamam.
The place of action, the body, the performer, the various senses, the many different kinds of endeavor, and ultimately the supersoul. These are the five factors of action. And one more.
Shariravang manobhiryat karma prarabhate nara nyayam va viparitam va panchayate tasya hetavah.
Whatever right or wrong action a man performs by body, mind, or speech is caused by these five factors. Okay, these are short purports, so let's read the purports for 13 and 14. The translation again for 13. O mighty armed Arjun, according to the Vedanta, there are five causes for the accomplishment of all action. Now learn of these from me. Purport. A question may be raised that since any activity performed must have some reaction, how is it that the person in Krishna consciousness does not suffer or enjoy the reactions of work? The Lord is citing Vedanta philosophy to show how this is possible. He says that there are five causes for all activities, and for success in all activity, one should consider these five causes. Sankhya means the stock of knowledge, and Vedanta is the final stock of knowledge accepted by all leading acharyas. Even Shankara accepts Vedanta Sutra as such. Therefore, such authority should be consulted. The ultimate control is invested in the Supersoul, as it is stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Sarvasya Chaham Hridi Sannivishtah. He is engaging everyone in certain activities by reminding him of his past actions. And Krishna conscious acts done under his direction from within yield no reaction, either in this life or in the life after death. Text 14. The place of action, the body, the place of action, which is the body, the performer, the various senses, the many different kinds of endeavor, and ultimately the supersoul. These are the five factors of action. Purport. The word adhishthanam refers to the body. The soul within the body is acting to bring about the results of activity and is therefore known as karta, the doer. That the soul is the knower and the doer is stated in the Shruti. Esha hi drashta srashta. Prashna Upanishad 4.9. It is also confirmed in the Vedanta Sutra by the verses Gnyota Eva and Karta Shastrarthavatvat. The instruments of action are the senses, and by the senses the soul acts in various ways. For each and every action there is a different endeavor, but all one's activities depend on the will of the Supersoul, who is seated within the heart as a friend. The Supreme Lord is the super cause. Under these circumstances, he who is acting in Krishna consciousness under the direction of the Supersoul, situated within the heart, is naturally not bound by any activity. Those in complete Krishna consciousness are not ultimately responsible for their actions. Everything is dependent on the Supreme Will, the Supersoul, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Om Jnanantimirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Jena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manohishtam Sthapitam Jena Kulpana Swayam Rupa Gada Mahyam Dadati Swadhanantikam Mukam Karoti Vacharam Pankam Kriyate Giri Tyat Kripatam Hum Vande Shri Gurum Dina Karanam So I'm sure you remember earlier on in this chapter, in the beginning of the 18th chapter, in the purport to the first verse, Srila Prabhupada says something very important for this chapter. And basically he says that the Bhagavad Gita is done in 17 chapters. The 18th chapter is simply a summary of everything that's happened before. So he's saying that basically Krishna is going over stuff that's already been covered in the previous 17 chapters. And one exercise that's very useful is to look at the contents of the 18th chapter and see where Krishna spoke in them already. Because we have to remember that Bhagavad Gita is a conversation between Krishna and Arjuna. It's a conversation between two people. It's not a some kind of an impersonal, you know, treatise or bill of rights or some kind of a document or a legal document where every word counts and you have to, you know, analyze it. No, it's a conversation. And what a conversation means is, like in any conversation, if you want to get your point across, then you go over the same things over and over again. So you kind of, those things which you consider very important, you repeat them, right? You say, so, like I said, please remember to do this and like that. And the person goes, yeah, what was the third thing you said I should do? He said, okay, do, you know, go make sure you go to the grocery store and get some, you know, potatoes or whatever. So, yeah, okay. So you go over the same thing and it's considered completely normal, right? In a legal document, you would never repeat stuff like that, right? At the beginning, you say, like, the first party, they're referred to as they in the document, right? And then everywhere else is they. And the second party is referred to as us. And everywhere it says us is that. And once you define that at the beginning of your document, that's it. You never have to say it again. But that's not how real life operates. That's not how conversations happen between people. Conversations are real-time things where you often have to repeat yourself in order to make sure your point is conveyed. In other words, what Krishna is doing here is he's teaching. He's a teacher. And what a teacher has to do is not just... that's the difference between a teacher and a textbook, right? A textbook will go over the material, but you might read it and miss out on the important points or focus on the points that are not so important. But the teacher is able to say, look, this is important in the textbook. Make sure you study this for the exam. This is not so important. You don't have to worry about it. So Krishna, he's the guru. At the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna, he accepted Krishna as the guru. He says, Shishyasteham shadhimam tvam praparna. I'm your shishya. I'm your disciple. A soul surrendered unto you. Please instruct me. So now Krishna, he's speaking in conversation as a teacher. And so, like a good teacher, at the end of his whole lesson, he's reviewing everything that he's spoken to Arjuna so far. He said, I told you this, I told you this, I told you. And he's going over the whole Bhagavad Gita again. But it's not some kind of a, you know, like a mechanical repetition. Krishna is emphasizing those points he considers very important. He's making sure Arjuna realizes what's important. And at the end of this chapter, of course, we know Krishna will make it very clear what he considers to be most important. And what is that? Most important. Ian, you know? He says, I'll repeat to you my most important instruction. And he says two verses. Manmana bhava mad bhakto mad yajimam. Think of me, become my devotee, offer your homage unto me. And in this way you will come to me without doubt. And the second one he says is give up all varieties of religious practice, give up all varieties of ideas of religion, and just surrender yourself to me. So these two instructions, Krishna says, are the most important. And he tells this to Arjuna just before he lets him loose and says, you can do what you like. In fact, he tells him this just after he lets him loose. He says, you can do what you like, but listen to my most important instruction once more. Do as you like, but here's what I really think is important. He's telling Arjuna, you can do what you want, but not really. He's pushing. He's telling Arjuna, you can do what you want, but this is what I really think is what you should do. Think of me, become my devotee. Otherwise, there's no point in repeating those two verses. He's already told Arjuna, yathechasi tatha kuru, do as you like. So then why is Krishna going back and trying to influence his decision? Because Krishna thinks, he's making it clear what he thinks the right course of action is. So there's no doubt in the student's mind. Yeah, exactly. In case anyone has some weird interpretations, he's making his points absolutely clear. And some verses in this chapter you'll find to be very similar to earlier verses in Bhagavad Gita. So, especially that verse, Manmana Bhava Mad Bhakto, three of the four lines in that verse are taken exactly from the ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So, anyway, so this is kind of the background of this 18th chapter. It's a nice summary, a repetition, where Krishna's telling us. It's like before the final exam, there's a review day for my students. I hold a review day before any exam. And the review day, we go over what we've covered already. But it's very beneficial for students. All students attend on that day, right? Why? Even the students who've been attending every day of class still show up on the review day. Why? Yeah, because they know I'll do a review, but I will emphasize those things that come in the exam, right? That's the purpose of review. It's weighted. It's not a blind review. So the 18th chapter is kind of like that. It's a review, but it's not a blind review. Arjuna's test is coming. He's got a real life test to deal with. Namely, he's got to make this big decision and fight. So before the exam, Krishna's giving him a review, but he's emphasizing what he thinks is important. Now, now these verses, 13 and 14, this is actually very nice. In some sense, these few verses are something you don't find earlier in Bhagavad Gita, the specific points being made here. Krishna is saying that for any activity, there are five causes for that activity. What's the verse here? Karanani. There's five karanas, five causes. Panchaitani maha. Five pancha karana, five causes for any action. And any activity that's performed, he's saying, by body, mind, or words, sharira, vak, or man, manas, are actually carried out by these five causes. These five factors are what influence any action that's performed, either mental action, verbal action, or physical action. All three actions are controlled by these five. And he's saying the devotee is one who knows that these five are actually performing the action. And he is not, or she is not, the only doer of the activity. So the point Krishna is making here is that we shouldn't consider ourselves the cause of our activities. We shouldn't be proud as the performer of our activities. Because in fact, there are far more influences, factors that influence the outcome of an activity, that influence the activity itself, than just us. Earlier in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna has already made this point very strongly, the point that we're not the performer of our actions. Do you remember what Krishna said there? Or where it was? Krishna said very, very clearly. What is it? I think the fourth chapter? chapter. And he says, Krishna says, Prakrite kriyamanani gunai karmani sarvashah ahankara vimudhatma kartaham iti manyate. That the living entity who is bewildered by the modes of nature thinks of himself as the doer of activities which are in fact carried out by the three modes of nature. So we think ourselves the doer. He says, kartaham iti manyate. He thinks, kartaham, I am the karta, I am the doer. Ahankara vimudhatma. This is because he's illusioned, he's bewildered, he's stupid, vimudha. Why? Because of ahankara. Ahankara means false ego. Because of a false sense of self, a false sense of ego, he thinks, I'm doing all this activity. I've got this whole situation set up. I've got my house, and I've got my family, and I've got my job, and I've got everything set up very nicely. I've got all the bills being paid, and all the insurance being paid. So I'm the doer, karta. When in fact, actually, he's simply a puppet in the hands of material nature. Now, in these verses, Krishna gives a more detailed reason as to why we're not the doer. He's made this point earlier, that we're not the performer. But why aren't we the performer? Because Krishna's saying, it's not just you who's the doer of your activities. There's actually a lot more involved. There's four other things involved besides. Of the five factors of action, only one is us. Only one is the doer. In any activity, there's five causes and only one is us. Right? So we've only got 1/5 of the influence we think we do. Considering if they're all equally weighted, which they're not, we'll find out in a minute. So, what are the five here? It says Adhishtanam, Karta, Karana, Cheshta, and Daivam. Five things, he says. The place of action, Adhishtanam. The performer, Karta. The senses, Karanam. The endeavor itself, different kinds of endeavor, Cheshta. And the Supersoul, Daivam, or God, the Supreme Lord. Now, all five of these go into performing an action. Now, to make this clear, we can give a metaphor, an analogy. Just like, suppose a potter is making a pot, some kind of a jug or something. Now, I don't know how in... Today, we're not so familiar with the process of pottery. But potters in India have a wheel, usually. Right? And they're turning the wheel really, really fast. And from the wheel, they create the potter's wheel. Right? So in creating a pot, suppose in the end, we go to the market and we buy a pot. And we say, what was the cause of the pot? How would you answer that question if I were to ask? You buy a pot in the store and say, what was the cause of the pot? Let's not think in spiritual terms here. But we're just speaking really basically. How would you answer that question? What or who was the cause of the pot? What caused the pot? The potter. Okay, so that's the first thing that comes to mind. The potter makes the pot. And this is his job. This is where he produces several hundred pots a day. And you can see him turning the wheel and creating the pot. Say, okay, the potter creates the pot. But... what else? What else is the cause of the pot besides the potter? What else can you think of? Clay. Okay. So the substance itself. If there's no clay, there's no pot. So clay is the cause of the pot. What else? The wheel. Very good. The wheel. What is the wheel in abstract terms? What would it be called? It's the instrument he uses. Right? It's the tool. We call it the tool. Yeah, the place. So, how would you put that in terms of our pot here? Perhaps if we go ahead. Yeah, I mean, if we thought of it broadly, you could say the circumstances in which the potter finds himself, right? So the place, the weather, the working conditions, the light he has, you know, the temperature, all the circumstances that go into it. Okay, and then what else? There's still another cause we're looking for. And like I said, we're not thinking in God terms here. So. Yeah, this is described as one cause here, right? The cheshta, the endeavor itself. Now, to me, it's not exactly clear what the difference is between the endeavor and the performer as the cause. Because the performer is performing. But anyway, I'm looking for one more cause. Yeah, so you mean the potter? Yeah. But okay, think about it like this. Yeah, well, see, that's what Krishna's talking about as cheshta, right? So let's start correlating this here, and then we'll get to this last one we're missing. Okay, I think it'll make it clear. So we said the performer. Krishna's saying one of the causes is the karta, the performer. That we mentioned as the potter. That was the first thing that came to mind. He's the cause, okay? Then Krishna says karanam, which he says are the various senses. The word karana means instruments or tools. So in any activity, there are tools that the performer uses. In the case of the potter, it's the potting wheel, the tool he's using. In the case of the living entity, us, the instruments we use, the tools we use, are the senses. Okay? Because that's the most, that's the basic instrument we have to use. Whether we use a hammer or a potter's wheel or anything, but in order to use the hammer, in order to use the potter's wheel, we need our senses. So that's the first level of instruments we need. If our senses are blocked off, we're completely useless for doing anything. Right? So that's why the senses are called the most important instruments. Now, how many senses do we have? Five, right? Seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, tasting. But also, the philosophy of Sankhya speaks about other senses also. These are the five, what we just named were the five knowledge-acquiring senses. It's the senses through which we gain knowledge about the world. So different ways of perceiving the world. You can taste something, you can smell. If you want to find out what is this, I give you a lump of white powder or white grains. So how do you figure out what it is? Well, you can smell it first. It doesn't smell like anything. Okay, then you can listen to it. Well, it doesn't hear like anything. You can drop it on the floor and see what it hears like. You can take a look at it, examine the grains, right? If it's thicker grains or little grains, thicker grains gives you a hint, it's probably what? Sugar. Smaller grains, probably salt. What else? In the end, you can taste it. Now, you taste it and it becomes very clear. This is sugar or salt. If you do all of these things, smell, hear, taste, still get nothing, then it's probably what? Anthrax or something. Some horrible chemical you don't want to get close. So our senses, this is how we acquire knowledge. But besides the five knowledge acquiring senses, Sankhya also speaks about five working senses. So these would be, let's see if I can remember, the hands, the legs, the tongue, the anus and genitals. Yeah. Hands, legs, tongue, anus, I think so, yeah. These are the five working senses, is how we actually perform activities in this world. With these five things. Okay, so that makes 10. And then five sense organs? Yeah, the eyes, the nose, the ears. Eyes, nose, ears, tongue, and then skin again. So that makes 15. And then there's mind, intelligence, ego. 18. And then sometimes our consciousness, our contaminated consciousness is included as one. 19. 16, 17, 18. Yeah. So, no, but I'm missing a set of five because there's 23. He said five sense objects, five knowledge acquiring senses, five working senses, five sense organs, and there's another group of five I'm missing. Because that makes 20, and then you have the three extra. Yeah, yeah, there's the five sense objects. Right. Form. Form. Sound. Yeah. No, those are much more basic. In any case, we've got all these senses, right? And these are the instruments we use to perform the action. Okay. So, the performer, the various senses, which are the instruments of action, the tools. This is called nimitta, nimittakara, the tools we use to perform the action. Okay. And then Krishna says the place of action. And here, Prabhupada explains that the place of action means the body, adhishthana. This is where we, the living entity, are situated. Okay. This is the field of our activities. So the living entity is called kshetragya and the body is called kshetra. The body is the field of activities and we are the knower of the field. Now again, if you remember from Bhagavad Gita, it's been a while, but we had a whole chapter on knower in the field and the performer, right? All those things. It's a rather complicated chapter. But basically the idea is we are the knower and this is the field. So we're the performer, knower, performer. And this is the field of our activities. Everything that we do with our senses, it happens right here in the body. So this is the place of activity. Okay? And then, the endeavor itself. The Jeshta. Prabhupada says in the purport, every action has a particular type of endeavor that's associated with it. Jeshta, which means an attempt or a desire to perform something, an action. And then the fifth one, which is actually the most crucial one, and that's Daivam, or the super soul, or God. Now, in our analogy of the potter, right, we said, okay, we named the clay itself, the potting wheel, we named the potter himself, his circumstances, the place, you know, so many things we named, right? But there's one thing, one cause, which is very important, which we didn't talk about, right? That if that cause is absent, there's no way the potter can make a pot. The whole process stops immediately. There's no reason to create the pot. The potter won't even start making the pot. Okay, desire's there, but even more than that. Well, yeah, where's the desire produced from? Well, what is the desire of the potter? Yeah. To make money, exactly. And where does that money come from? Where does that money come from? From the customers, right? So, who's the customer? The buyer. The person who says, I want the pot, I need a pot, his clientele. Right? Those are actually the cause, right? Because if he doesn't have any customers, right, if there's no one to sell to, then there's no reason to produce. In other words, the market, the audience he's selling to, will be the ultimate cause. Right? Like some people with, for eating meat, right? They say, the meat is killed already, the animal's killed already, so it's not, you know, I can eat it then. But the point is, the animal wouldn't be killed if you didn't want to eat it, right? You're the market. You're the reason why they're killing the animals, because there's people who want to eat it. Right? So saying that the animal is dead already, and therefore it's not so bad to eat it, is foolish, because you're the cause, ultimately, for the animal being killed. You're the reason. Right? So the customer, the market, is very important as a cause for the performer, right? The reason. So the Supreme Lord, God, He's the ultimate cause behind it. He's the ultimate reason why everything's happening. And if he's not present, then there's no reason for this whole cosmos to at all wake up or work at all. No reason for anything to get started in this material world. If Krishna's not there as the ultimate, the final cause. He's the reason why everything... He's the purpose towards which everything is directed. That's God. the whole creation is working to fulfill the Lord's purpose. And if that purpose is not there, if Krishna is not there as a motivating force, then everything is gone. Daivam, the super soul. So all five of these things put together constitute the causes of an action. This is what causes something to happen. So it becomes very foolish of us to think of ourselves as the controllers of our own situation. That we're the ones who perform, we're the ones who control this world. Krishna is saying, no, it's pretty clear that we're dependent in this world. Everything depends on someone else. Well, a fifth, I guess. Okay, right. Very good. Let's analyze our activities, analyze our actions. We'll come to your question in just a minute. Okay. If we look at any kind of activity that we perform in this world, and we sit down and without a sense of pride, we try to examine what it is that produced this result, that got me where I was. What do we find? What do we see? First thing Krishna mentions is the place or the circumstances of performing. We're all born into particular circumstances. We're all born with a particular type of body. And because of that, let's take, for example, an education, getting a degree. Right? I get my BA or MA or PhD. Now, that's the end result. And I'm prone to think that I was the performer of that activity, that I was the cause. I worked hard and I got a PhD. This is the natural tendency. But if I sit down and I say, okay, let's take a look at these five factors of action that Krishna gives and see how much I'm actually credited with in this degree that I got. Let's see how much is actually due to me. Well, first thing Krishna says is the body or the place, the circumstances I'm born into. I've been born into a particular family. I've been given a particular type of body. My body has a certain set of mental capabilities. And my parents have certain amount of resources which allow me to have a good education from childhood. My father makes a good living and therefore my mother can stay home and she can homeschool us. And we get a good education and they have good habits and neither of my parents are drunkards and they don't come home yelling and screaming. And I have a stable house and a stable family. None of this I chose. That a nice family, a nice situation, a well-to-do place, a birth in America with a good educational system, a peaceful circumstances, the country's, there's no one bombing the country, there's no bombs dropping. None of that I chose. It's just placed into that circumstance. And specifically the body I've been given. Right? I could have been born, completely incapable or whatever it might be. So many things could have gone wrong. But the circumstances were right. So, I went to university, I got a degree, I got another degree, I got another degree, and so forth. That's one thing, the place, the situation we found ourselves in. Then, Krishna says the various instruments, or the various senses, and that should be quite obvious, right? If we think of instruments or tools even more broadly, then we can say, well, there's so many instruments that were important. The financial help. Whether it was through scholarships or through my parents, the support, family support, or material needs, necessities, gasoline, tools, study tools, lights, papers, computers. Computers are such a big instrument, tool. Right? Printers to print stuff out. So many of those things are there. And my senses, of course. The endeavor itself. Now, I don't, like I said earlier, I don't exactly understand what this endeavor is, Krishna's meaning by this endeavor, or cheshta. Yeah. Exactly, the endeavor itself seems to be the action. But perhaps Krishna means more like desire, or the impetus. Yeah, but that seems, but that seems like the performer, the karta. No, but it's the performer who's the cause of the endeavor. So the cause would be the performer then, right? But what does it mean for the endeavor to be the cause? Yeah.
I have this book at home sitting there. If I don't feel like it, I don't have a desire to open it.
Right.
The book is not going to come to me.
Right.
Read to me.
Right. So that's yeah.
It's still a performance.
Yeah. This.
But the desire makes it real.
Yeah. So maybe the impetus for activity, the desire, the word cheshta has that sense. Yes. No, but that. But the actor is the performer. He's the karta. So he's already included as the cause. So does that come under the karta or the cheshta?
Cheshta.
And what's the karta then?
Karta is
doing that.
So then karta is doing the cheshta, which means karta is the cause of the cheshta. I'm saying if you give the endeavor over to another cause, then there doesn't seem to be much left to the karta as a cause, other than his just being there. What I was thinking in terms of our analogy is that like going to college, you can have all the circumstances I described, but still, many times people don't go to college because no one in their family previously has. There's no culture of, no impetus, no endeavor to go to college. Kind of parents haven't gone, grandparents, everyone says, you can just, leave high school and you can get a good job, whatever it is. And so they have these special scholarships for first-time college students, people who are the first in their family to go to college, because they don't normally have the support system, the endeavor. So I was thinking in terms of that, that endeavor, that desire is not there in them. I don't know.
And it seems like we're breaking it down, what I was talking about, being a dream, if you're super slow, super pushed down to the planet, he's doing it all, and we're sitting here in the material nature, trying to sort out which one the five and what.
Yeah.
It
Right. Because you're right, because Krishna says earlier in Bhagavad Gita, if you remember, that he tells Arjuna that the intricacies of action are very difficult to understand. And he says, gahana karmano gati, the path or the pathway of action is very difficult to understand. He says, those who see action and inaction and inaction and action, you remember that? They're the people in true knowledge, but he says, this is very difficult to understand. And I'll try to explain it to you, but still it's very, very difficult. So what exactly causes an activity and what the results or reactions of the actions are is not an easy thing to sort out. Knowledge, the object of knowledge and the knower. These factors that motivate action. Karma chodana, yeah. That's talking about chodana. So then you're probably right in that the endeavor Krishna counts as a separate thing. And then the performer is more like the agent who kind of engages in the endeavor, but in itself, in himself, is not really. In other words, the causes are not completely distinct. The endeavor is engaging in the activity, in the endeavor itself. Yeah, Prabhupada is saying here, he's hinting that in the purport, that there are many different kinds of endeavors for the performance of an action. Yeah, or different ways in making the effort. So we have a particular goal to something we want, and there's different ways of approaching it, different endeavors you make. You know, you try this way, you try that way, you try that. Right. Yeah, I think the analogy of the money making thing is works well, because there are different ways of, like you said, you can invest in the stock market, you can buy property, and you know, you can just save in a bank account. But depending on how you choose it and at what time and what way, you're gonna get a different result. Yeah, I think that would come under the category of the performer, the karta, the doer. Perhaps again, this is the point in debate. You know, perhaps it comes under the category of the endeavor. Yeah, see, that's probably better than the Hindi meaning for cheshta, because in Hindi, cheshta means more like a desire or an impetus. Like you're saying, I think here, and Prabhupada is making it very clear in the word for word, cheshta is meaning endeavor, the activity. So that's good. That's very good. Yeah. Okay. So that's the fifth cause we're coming to. Okay. We covered these for you before we go to the fifth one. Do you have?
No, I just want to add a comment on the example. I was thinking, and there would be his will to make a path, right? Mm. I mean, he can make a path in any shape, and that particular path he wants it to be nice shape and how he does it. I mean, his hands can move.
Right.
He's not going to do a path that he
Yeah. It's I think it's as clear as it's gonna get now. I think Srinivasa's distinction is also good in that whether we're discussing the action itself or the result of the action. Because speaking about a PhD or making money is more speaking about the result of the activity. Whereas in an action itself, suppose I say, I want to sing or to play a mridanga. Right? Then it's very clear how these five things work together. Right? You need the body to play the mridanga. You need your senses to be able to hear it and keep the rhythm. You need the performer. The individual has to be there. You have the endeavor of beating the mridanga. And ultimately, you have the sanction of the Supreme Lord to do it. So with an action, it's actually very clear. Perhaps the confusion is because we're speaking about the results of the actions. Right? So it's a good thing. Effort to move the senses. So that goes more in line to with your. Yeah, that the effort you put. Yeah, so the effort you put in, like you were saying, and that effort would be very closely related, I guess, to the will you have, which you've been saying is that the will behind it is the. Yeah, to drag yourself out of bed to get to the early morning class. Right. Yeah, in the early morning class, there's many students who cannot make the endeavor to actually come up, drag themselves out of bed and come to class. So even though all the other circumstances could be there, means the performer is there, the agent of the action is there, and all the other circumstances, but they actually never make it to class. The endeavor isn't there. No, I think that's very right. That is a fundamental problem in what we were doing earlier, is we're trying to separate them out too distinctly. The endeavor is wrapped up with the performer, and the fact that it is not a surprise or it's not a problem, because that's the way it's supposed to be. Yep. So it's kind of like if you take one of these out of the five, then all five of them kind of, or all at least four of them kind of fall apart, because they're all pretty, like you're saying, pretty tied together. Now, the kind of the most important one is what we haven't talked about yet, and that's the Supreme Lord, Daiva. Daiva means divine, literally the person who's the divine factor in all of this, the divinity. And here Srila Prabhupada is saying specifically the super soul. Now, how is the super soul part of every action we perform? Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, he says, Sarvasya chaham pidi sannivishto matta smriti jnanam apohanamcha, that I'm situated within the hearts of all living entities. Sarvasya chaham pidi sannivishto. And matta smriti jnanam apohanamcha. From me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. He also says, Hridesha Arjuna Tishthati Brahmayan Sarvabhutani Yantra Rudhani Maya. Says, Ishwara Sarvabhutana Hridesha Arjuna. The Supreme Lord, Ishwara, is present in the hearts of all living entities, and He is directing the wanderings of all living entities. So, Krishna, He's there in our hearts as Super Soul. And as Super Soul, His role is very, very important. What does the Super Soul do? How is He actually part of our actions? Again, Krishna defines the role of the Super Soul very clearly. He says, Upadrashtanu mantacha bharta bhokta maheshwara paramatmeti chapyukto dehismin purushapara. He says, in the body, dehismin purushapara, there is a Supreme Lord, a Supreme Person, who is called Paramatma. And what does the Paramatma do? He's Upadrashta Anumanta Bharta Bhokta Maheshwara. He says, Upadrashta, he is the overseer. He sees everything. He's watching everything, the witness. Anumanta, and he's the permitter. So he gives us permission, sanctions it. Okay, you can do it. It doesn't necessarily mean he approves of it, but he permits it. Okay, there's a big difference between approving and permitting. Upadrashta anumanta cha bharta. And he's the supporter. He's supporting everyone. He's maintaining everyone. Without him, the whole thing collapses completely. So, when the super soul is there, present within the body of every living entity, in our hearts, in our bodies, in fact, in every atom of this material creation, he's the one who's kind of holding it all up. As soon as the super soul is gone, the whole thing collapses. Because without the permission of the super soul, we, the living entity, are powerless to perform any kind of activity. And we can see this. When the super soul decides to, when the Lord decides to take away the resources we have, for example, if we want to perform something, we want to do well on an exam, and suddenly the memory goes blank, there's nothing you can do about it. Right? If suddenly, the power of the senses is taken away from us, we have a heart attack or something goes wrong, or whatever. We cannot, one little thing can happen in this world and all our power to manipulate anything in this world is completely taken away. It's completely gone. One example, there's a famous, who is the guy who played Superman? Yeah. He was, perfect life. Right? Just so rich, so powerful, so happy, perfect family, beautiful house, horses. Like, this is American ideal life, right? To have your own horses and you can ride in the countryside. Everyone dreams of having horses. Perfect life. And one day, he's on his horse, breeze is blowing, beautiful day, jumps a fence, the horse hits the fence, falls, trips, he gets thrown off the horse, and breaks his neck. And he's paralyzed from the neck down for the rest of his life. Now, imagine one little moment, one little instance, and everything that's perfect, all his capabilities. The irony of the whole situation was, he was the actor, he was the performer, right? And what was the role he was acting? Superman, right? The complete epitome, the example of, I am the doer, Kartaham. Who is more an example of I'm the doer than Superman? If no one can do it, Superman can do it. And if Superman cannot do it, then no one can do it. Right? So he's the doer, Kartaham. But that power to perform, Karta, when all the other four factors of action were all present for him, the doer, the body, perfect doer, he had the endeavor, he was motivated, desire, everything we've talked about was there. But one moment and everything was taken away. This is called daivam, or divine cause. Whether you attribute it to the laws of karma, or you attribute it to God, or whatever it might be. But something there beyond his control that in one instant took everything away. Another example. This season was especially bad for hurricanes. We saw more hurricanes than in the last century, I think. For the first time, they ran out of names. You can choose one name from every letter of the alphabet when the hurricanes arrive. Right? And they ran out of names. Out of the 26, you can't choose X, and there's a few letters you can't choose, right? And you had alpha. Then you have to start on the Greek letters. Alpha, beta, gamma, or whatever it is. And delta, gamma. They were at epsilon, I think. Yeah, it was the latest one they had. So it was a huge, huge season. And we saw especially the destruction in places like New Orleans. Right? So, again, you can say one of the, you know, amazing city and, you know, people glorifying New Orleans as the heart of America, and the jazz, and this and that, and this is where life is, and the capital of sense gratification, and the Mardi Gras, so much. Everything is there. Right? Sin City, yeah. So everything is there. And then one evening, right? Everyone's watching. Everyone's seeing it on the satellite radar screens. Everyone's been warned. Everyone sees it coming. All our technology can show us that this is going to happen. And yet, still, there was absolutely nothing we could do when it actually hit. And the whole city is a big bowl of full of water. Completely devastated. What is the cause of that? All the other four factors, again, were present there. If New Orleans doesn't have motivation, what city does, right? If New Orleans doesn't have the body, the capability, everything is there. But in one minute, it's all gone. Why? Daivam. It says daivam means divine. Divine cause. It's adi bhotik, adi daivik. The misery is caused by natural circumstances or divine causes. So in every feature of our action, if we look at it carefully, the super soul's giving witness and permission is extremely important. It's very, very important. Without that there's absolutely nothing we can do for performing action. However, in the performance of our action, we cannot blame our activities or attribute our activities to the super soul unless we actually perform our activities in accordance with the desire of the super soul. Because if we say, suppose you kill someone, and you say, well, there's five factors to action, and therefore I attribute this to God. God made me do it. In some sense, it's true, because God permitted you to do it. Without the Lord there in the heart saying, act out your desires, I'm not going to interfere. This is your field of activities. The body's your field, you've got your senses, you can perform your activities. That action would not have happened. That's most definitely true. But the action itself cannot be attributed to God or blamed on God unless the Lord's approval is there. And this is why we draw the distinction between permission and approval. Because the Lord is permitting every activity, and in that sense you can say he's responsible for it. But he's not approving it. And unless he approves of the action, we cannot attribute the blame on him. Right? If he's not approving it, then we will get the reaction to that action and we'll suffer for the problem. Just like if a criminal performs some kind of a crime, assaults someone or robs a house or whatever, in some sense you can blame it on the government. You can blame it on the city. Right? You can say the circumstances were there, the house was there, you're not enough security, da da da. And people do blame it on the city. Right? But that doesn't mean that when the criminal goes to court, he can hold this up as a defense and say it was the city's fault. Right? Why does the city not have a better police force? Why doesn't the city have a better preventative program? If the city did, I wouldn't even have this problem. Right? Why does the city not have more social programs for those who are down and out? That's a big problem, and it's a valid criticism. Right? But it still doesn't let the criminal loose or let him free from responsibility for his action. No jury is ever going to say, yeah, you know, it's all the police's fault. We should have had a better police force. If we did, then you wouldn't have done your action, isn't it? So therefore, it's their fault. You should go. You can continue with your action. We'll try to improve the police force. No, that doesn't work. Nice example. Or more recently in France, right? All the riots that were taking place in France. So in other words, there is a point, there is a way in which we can shift all responsibility to God. In the five factors of action, we can remove all responsibility from us, the performer, and shift it to God. And Prabhupada is making that very clear in the purport. He says, a devotee is not responsible for any of these actions. Why? Because the actions he performs are in accordance with the orders, desires, and will of the Lord. When you do it in accordance with his desire, then yes, you're free of that responsibility. Because you're performing it for in accordance with what. Then if it goes wrong, then it's his problem. But that's the only circumstance in which you can shift blame. Otherwise, you have to accept the blame. Three different ways. Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. By the instruction of the spiritual master, the consultation, the approval, the advice of fellow devotees, senior devotees, the community, and by the scripture. These three things are ways in which we can get an idea as to what the Lord wants. So we ask the spiritual master gives an instruction. Or in some cases, if he's not present to give the instruction, then we can also consult with our fellow devotees, understand, well, what do you think is the right course of action? Should we do this? Should we not? In the community of the faithful. And then look to scripture, look to Shastra. And all three of these things together will give us a fairly good idea of what we should do. But it's interesting, here in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna himself is standing on the battlefield and telling Arjuna what to do. But even Krishna is not simply using his own authority. He's the guru, right? Krishna is the guru. We just said, shishyasteham. Arjuna says, you're the guru. But what does Krishna do as a guru? We just read in this verse. What is he quoting in this verse? He's not basing it on his own. Several times in the Bhagavad Gita, he looks for authority. Who is he quoting here in the verses we just read? Vedanta Sutra. He's quoting from the Shastras, from scriptures. Even Krishna, many times in Bhagavad Gita, he says, according to the Vedanta it is said, or the sages in the past have said. Even Krishna finds the need. As God himself, he's still setting the example that all three things have to be taken into account. Otherwise, any one of them have a potential to go haywire, to go wrong. So shifting blame is not an option. We have to, if we're working in complete sync with Krishna's desires, then it's. That's the whole problem of evil, as to why there is evil in a world with a good God. If God is, the problem is it's a perennial problem, but it basically says, well, if God is omniscient, here's the argument, right? If God is omniscient, then He knows about all the suffering that's happening in this world. If God is omnipotent, then He has the power to stop all the suffering in this world. And if God is omnibenevolent, then He will, if God is all good, in other words, then He will stop all the suffering in this world. But He doesn't. So God is not one of the three. One of the three has to be false. Right? This is the basic argument of those who use the problem of evil to argue against God. Right? Something has to be wrong there. That if God knows everything, He knows the suffering. If He's all-powerful, He's able to stop the suffering. And if He's all-good, He would stop the suffering. But there's still suffering. And therefore, God is either doesn't know everything, or He doesn't have the power to change everything, some people have argued, or He's not very good, in which case He's not really God. Okay. Okay, very nice, very good. See, that's exactly where in the arguments chain where I would question the different steps of the argument is the third one, exactly where Darlene said. He said, if God knows everything, He knows the suffering in the world. Right? Okay, no problem with that. If God knows the suffering, if God is all-powerful, He has the power to stop it. Yeah, no problem with that. If God is all-good, He would stop it. But what Darlene is asking is, why? Perhaps there's greater good in not stopping it. Right? Perhaps there's a purpose to the suffering. So this is where the faithful see, okay, is there a purpose to suffering? Because this is a very fundamental point that Darlene made, is if suffering in this world is the basic impetus to seek out the Lord. If there was no suffering in this world, this might as well be the spiritual world, and there might as well be no God, no need for God at all. Queen Kunti says this in Srimad Bhagavatam also. She says, She asks Krishna for suffering over and over again. Vipada santuta shashvat tatra tatra jagat guru. Bhavato darshanam yad syat apunar bhava darshanam. Because when I get to see suffering in this world, then I get to see you. Because suffering causes me to remember you, and when I remember you, you're actually present there to help us. As soon as the suffering is gone, I don't think of you. And therefore, I mean, that's not the way it should be, but that is the way it is for most of us in this world. Yes, exactly. So that's the second big reason that Prabhupada gives for the existence of evil in this world, or the problem of evil. The argument is basically this, if I understand you correctly. The criminal can say, right, that he's languishing in prison and can say, look, the government is supposed to be good. It's supposed to look after the citizens of this country. I'm here suffering in prison. Why doesn't the government do something to stop it? Prisons are a place of suffering. Why don't we break down prisons? Why don't we demolish the prisons? It's houses of suffering, right? But no. That reasoning doesn't work. Why not? Because the government sets up a system of law and order. If you work in accordance with that system, you're free. If you choose to work against it, then you go into prison. In some sense, yes, the government is responsible for that suffering, but not completely, right? The individual is still responsible. So we as living entities, God has set up the system. 3/4 of the creation is happy. It's wonderful. And we can live there very happily with Krishna. As long as we live with the system. Right? He's not asking, demanding a lot, just asking for us to acknowledge His presence and our relationship with Him. But if we choose to go against that, then He's got another system set up. And we have no right to complain if it's miserable there, right? Because we chose to go into that. We chose to flout the rules. We chose to go against the system. So complaining might be, you know, it has no strength behind it. No. The reason we gave is for our presence in this predicament in general, as a whole, right? We're stuck in the material world. Now, when we're stuck in the material world, we will encounter suffering situations. And why individual situations put us in the situation we're in, why we're put into individual circumstances we have to suffer. To answer that question, you have to look at the individual person, right? You can't look at all 50,000 people and say, all were sinful. No, maybe one of those persons, it was time for them to go back to Godhead, and their time in the material world is up. For that person, Hurricane Katrina would be a joyous occasion, right? For whatever reason, but Krishna is an excellent coordinator and an excellent planner, and He knows how to manage everything perfectly. There are millions and millions, billions and trillions of living entities in every part of this creation, and everyone is interacting and arranged just nicely so that everyone's getting just what they're due in this whole prison system. Right? So, again, if we go to the prison analogy, within the prison, there are moments of happiness for every prisoner, right? And moments of distress, moments of suffering. Points at which they might be thrown into you know, solitary confinement. It's miserable. Other points they might go out in the sun and play basketball or whatever. Right? Now you can say, why is it that all these... You can say you walk down the solitary confinement section of the prison and say, you mean all these people did something wrong? I said, yeah, but you have to look at the individual circumstances. What landed them there? Why are some persons suffering and some persons happy within the prison house? Overall, everyone's suffering. Everyone in the material world, even us sitting in this nice temple, we're all suffering in this material world, right? Because we're in the prison house. But why some person is in a heated room on a cold winter day in Boise, Idaho, with a meal ready to eat, right? And why another person is suffering, languishing in Hurricane Katrina, that we have to look at the individual circumstances. We cannot come and say all 50,000 people were sinful. That's completely it's inaccurate and it's callous, both.
So now, something beneficial to us.
Yeah. Srinivas? No, that's very, very nice. Very good. Very nice. Very, very good. That section of the Bhagavatam is so it's just very appropriate, you know, very nice. I'm glad you brought it up. That Bhishma Dev, he's surveying the life of the Pandavas. And he's saying, for those who are so closely dedicated to Krishna, who could be closer to Krishna than the Pandavas? Arjuna was such a close friend. Even all of you, he's saying, had to suffer such a horrible life, you know. 14 years of exile in the forest to see their wife humiliated, to have them stripped of everything they owned, to have watched all their family and friends and children and everyone killed in a battlefield. And you're friends with God? No, I said, you know, it's like, this is like the problem of evil completely put under a magnifying glass. And you say, this is, you know, surely then God is not all good, right? Because if he puts his own people to that, then how could he do that? But then he says, same thing, he says, this must be due to the inevitable force of time. What does that mean? We're in the material world, we're in a prison house, don't expect to be happy. If you're there for some reason or another, whatever your reason might be, you're going to be swept up by it, right? Even if we go to the prison as ministers to teach, we still have to go through that security check. We have to go through the course. And if a prisoner chooses to stab us, we can't blame anyone, right? This is one of the things they make us sign, they make us understand, right? Because you're in a prison house, you can't expect anything better, right? Even if you're not meant to be there, you might get caught up in the whole scene that takes place, right? There's dangers involved. And that's such a good answer, because like you're saying, for devotees, it's sometimes a question, you know? But who could be a better example of that than the Pandavas? Yeah. Exactly. Right. It's like Hanuman Swami says, you know, he says, no one falls from the spiritual world. He said, we all jump from the spiritual world. You know? And it makes good sense, because the word fall tends to imply an accident, like someone pushed us off, you know. But no, there's no way to make an accident and slip and come into the material world. No, we jump off. We think, whoa, that's a great place, and let's jump, you know. So we choose to do this. And so, in the end, we don't really have a right to complain. Our main energies should be dedicated not to complaining, but to getting out. This is the point. Yes, Madhulay?
Would you call that collective karma?
Yeah, something like that.
So everything is collective, it's a whole soup, and you're just doing it.
Yeah. You're fine. There's a nice example that's given actually by the Sikhs. They give this example for suffering this world. There's a story. Once Guru Nanak, the head of the Sikhs, he was going with a disciple of his, and the disciple asked the same question. He says, "Why is it that so many people apparently innocently die?" You know, and he answers like this about collective karma. Basically, he says, "I'll answer to you. It's okay. Take some rest for a while." So the assistant lies down under the tree, and as he's lying, there's some drop of food or something that he didn't clean up after eating. And all these ants crawl up on him, and one of them bites him. And he goes, "Oh!" And he sweeps them all away. You know? And Guru Nanak says, "Why did you kill them all?" He said, "Well, the one was biting me." He said, "And therefore you killed them all." He said, "Yeah, because of the fault of one, they all died." So, in other words, it's kind of collective karma. We're all here. We're all guilty of the same crime, basically. Right? What's our crime? Rebelling against Krishna. Right? Forgetting Krishna. Not remembering. Trying to go against Krishna. We're all here. So, we shouldn't be surprised if we get caught up in the circumstances. Right? The key is we remember how to deal with those circumstances. How we react to them. That's the important thing. Right? This is what Srinivas was talking about earlier. No. Yeah, yeah. So the idea of collective karma is kind of to explain the big situation. But if you look at it individually, then yes, the second point, second option is better. That every individual's path is tracked by God. We can imagine it like a big supercomputer. And everyone's pathways and where we're going to meet and where we're going to go is all calculated based on our karma, based on our desires, based on what we deserve. Right? So for those who are devotees, Katrina might be their doorway back to Godhead. For those who are sinful, it might be suffering that they deserve. Right? For others, a guy who is homeless in New Orleans, he gets swept up in the whole thing, evacuates the town, gets a shelter, and he's got a life better. He's got daily food and meals ready to eat that were better than what he had before. Right? So we look at the big thing with our very limited vision. We look at the whole circumstance and we said, aha, God's at fault. But we don't understand the individual circumstances everyone is in. Krishna knows our individual history. He knows everything that we should get and should not get. And he deals with us personally. God, it sometimes looks like the hand sweeping away the ants. That's what it looks like to us. But for God, He's dealing with each of us individually. He's dealing with each of us personally. God doesn't do these impersonal, He uses, what is it? It's precision-guided missiles, right? He hits the target. He doesn't, throw a blunderbuss or a bomb and just destroy the whole thing. It's like, oops, I got a few that didn't deserve it. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. No, it was actually a fact. There's devotees who somehow managed to get some word out, and afterwards they wrote a report. And it was quite amazing. Is the whole lower part of the temple was flooded, and they moved the deities upstairs, and the devotees were using every little resource they had to keep up the worship of the deities and to feed everyone around them. Right? They had this little food for life program running, and they would go out in boats or wading through water and getting food from any place that they could, and cook up these meals for these people. And the whole experience was actually very strengthening. One of the devotees had a problem, and he, I don't know what happened, he had a broke his back or had an asthma attack, some medical problem that was aggravated, and all the devotees got around and helped him, and he was shipped out, and devotees from Texas arrived, and you know, with a truck, and loaded these people out, and brought the deities, and the whole situation brought them closer to the deities in the temple, meaning they really felt that I have to come in and protect Krishna, right? That much in it was strengthening, right? Or someone who sits down in the middle of this, and the convention center kneels on their feet and says, "God, I really need your help here," right? That experience might have been brought that individual closer to God, that in a way that their regular life may never have. There's someone. Yeah. Yeah, for Krishna, for devotees, like you're saying, he's personally dispensing every... means Krishna gives everyone's allotted deal individually, but for devotees, he does it with his own hand, you know? It's not done through some kind of an agency. It's like for example, feeding the homeless, right? The government might do it through various agencies, but when you feed your own children, you do it with your own hand, right? So Krishna is like that. The king or the government might, the president might institute a multi-billion-dollar program to make sure everyone's fed and clothed, but when it comes to his own kids, he makes sure individually, did you get enough to eat, right? So for devotees, it's like that. Krishna's individually feeding them with his own hand and also slapping them with his own hand. See, this is the suffering part, right? Whereas the other person might again be left to the judicial system or whatever. But children, the parents, when parents discipline a child, they don't send him off to the court and say, you know, they threaten, of course, the police will get you, right? But they never send him off to the police, right? They always discipline the child with their own hand. They might give him a slap with his own hand, right? So even that suffering is, like you're saying, not really suffering, because it's a very personally given by the Lord Himself with His own hand for a very particular reason. So a devotee actually understanding that fact, understanding that personal protection, doesn't feel it as suffering, because he understands that it's coming from actually a loving hand. You know, the slap may sting, but the hand is still loving. Yeah. So there's no doubt that the devotee also has to feel pain, right? But when you know it's coming from someone who cares for you, then it's not suffering. It's like they say, what is it? The suffering is inevitable, but the pain is optional. Or the pain is inevitable, but the suffering is optional. Okay. Yeah, someone. Okay.
Yeah.
For someone who knows that the river is a pathway to heaven, then who wouldn't run into the river, you know? So again, it depends on the perspective. Yes. Very good question. So all the Chaurasi Lakhyoni, the 8,400,000 forms, they're all not created, they're not created randomly by God. These are all direct manifestations of the desires of the living entities. Meaning, we all have a certain combination of desires that we want to act out. Whether it is to be very, you know, some of us have a desire to be extremely powerful. Some people have this. Would you like it? Would you? You know, some people have this desire. As soon as you walk into the room, everyone cowers and moves into the corner. Right? Most of us, we wouldn't like that. But there's some people who do. You know, they just walk into the room and everyone goes and moves back. Right? If you have that kind of desire, what better body than a tiger, a lion? Right? If a tiger were to walk into this room, right, or into the forest, he moves through the forest. And not one living entity ever comes close. Right? They all fall back. So depending on each person's desire, what we have, Krishna creates a particular body. In the beginning, see, this is the point. In the beginning, you can say, well, living entities, when the living entity first comes to this material world, it said, for the first time, he gets the body of Brahma. The highest body possible in this material world. Krishna starts him off at the best possible location. And then we degrade ourselves from that. Right? No, no. It happens over a process in the creation. It takes some time. There's different prajapatis who give birth to the different... I think Kashyapa, from one of his wives, she gave birth to 1,000 varieties of snakes or something like that. Right? So different varieties of bodies come from at different times, depending on the desire of the living entity. But the thing is, the point is to find out the beginning is nearly impossible because the material creation goes so far back that we cannot say at some beginning. See, at the beginning of this... No. It's an evolution of consciousness. Means, actually, if you look at Darwin's scheme, ours is the same scheme itself. You start off from the aquatics and they kind of move to amphibious creatures and then come out on land and become beasts. It's the same scheme, but it's an evolution of consciousness. It means the individual Atma is going through all the whole stage. It's not that the bodies themselves are changing. For an individual living entity, when they show up is the Brahma. But there's no point in history at which we can go back and say, there was no one in the material world, let's start with soul number one. No, there's always been some living entities who have chosen to leave the spiritual world. So that question of in the very beginning doesn't actually work. You cannot ask that question. Because there's always been some living entity. So say at the beginning of this pralaya, this creation, this kalpa, Mahavishnu breathes out the universes and all these universes come out. Then Brahma comes and he starts creating the living entities. That's not the beginning. Brahma creates the living entities and part of, say, he creates tigers and elephants. You can say, well, why was that living entity started off as a tiger? In the previous kalpa, when everything, Mahavishnu was inside Mahavishnu's body, the last time it was out, the living entity stopped as a tiger. That was his desire. And till Mahavishnu, till it's the point of destruction, the living entity is dormant. His desires, he's just in a sleeping state. When the creation starts again, he starts off exactly where he left off at the last time. You see? So, at no point does Krishna put you randomly in any particular body. If you come for the first time, you start off as Brahma. But if you've been here before, you start off where you left off. Even if the last time you left off was a million years ago. He might hit the pause button, but the tape begins exactly where it was paused. Right? The pause button might last a million years, but it won't skip. You know? It'll start right there. You have a what? Right, right, exactly. We can't really talk about the beginning of this material creation because the scriptures say there's always someone or another who's into a mood of rebelling from Krishna. It's kind of like you can't really trace the time when there's, you know, the first prison house, because prisons are as old as governments, as civilization. You know, law-breaking citizens are as old as law-abiding citizens. When you have the law, you'll have both, kind of to begin with. So it's kind of like that. The material world kind of goes back as that. In fact, the Bhagavad Gita has five main themes it talks about. Five topics. Time, the material world, the living entities, karma, and Ishvara, and God. Right? And of those five, only one is temporary. Right? Four are eternal. The only one that's temporary is karma. All other four are eternal. Meaning this material world is also counted as eternal, beginningless. Only our karma has started at some point and has the potential to stop. Meaning mukti, moksha is possible. But all the four, time is eternal, the material world is eternal, we are eternal and God is eternal. But our karma is temporary. It's temporary in the sense that it's always in flux. It's always changing. It's going in and out. But it's still there, present within the Lord. Meaning his material energy, the Bahiranga Shakti, is eternal. Exactly. Okay, it's 9 o'clock. Okay, thank you very much for your time. Hare Krishna. Prasadam waiting.